14. Maniac loved his new life. He loved his new sneakers, the ones Mrs. Beale bought for him. He loved the quietness of his footsteps as he trotted Bow Wow through the early morning streets. He loved the early morning, the before the working people time, he called it, when even those who went to work the earliest were still sleeping behind their second-story shades, when it seemed as if the whole world had been created just before he woke up on his bedroom floor. The red brick rows of houses, even the windows resting from faces, the cool, silent sidewalks and streets. So quiet you could hear the water running far below the sewer grates while the sun shinnied up the rain spouts. He loved the silence and the solitude. But he also loved the noise, which came later in the day. He loved the sound of pancake batter hissing on the griddle. He loved the noise of the church they went to on Sunday mornings, a church called Bethany, when the minister would thump on the pulpit and the people would call out, "Amen," and the choir would swing this way and swing that way and would sing, "Hallelujah," to the people. And the people would sing, "Hallelujah," right back to the choir. And everyone just got happier and happier. And it all made him want to do more than run. So one day he just jumped himself up onto the pew bench and threw his arms to the sky and shouted at the top of his lungs, "Hallelujah! Amen!" And this time, nobody looked funny at the crazy kid yelling by himself. Then two members of his own family, Hester and Lester, jumped onto the bench with him and shouted away, "Hallelujah! Amen!" And everybody laughed and clapped and sang. He loved the 4th of July block party when the whole East End converged for a day and night of games and music and grilled chicken and ribs and sweet potato pie and dancing until the last firecracker and then some. Maniac loved the colors of the East End, the people colors. For the life of him, he couldn't figure out why these East Enders called themselves black. He kept looking and looking, and the colors he found were ginger snap and light fudge and dark fudge and acorn and butter rum and cinnamon and burnt orange, but never licorice, which to him was real black. He especially loved the warm brown of Mrs. Beale's thumb as it appeared from under the creamy white icing that she allowed him to lick away when she was frosting his favorite cake. He loved joining all the colors at the vacant lot and playing the summer days away, stickball, basketball, football. Half the time, he forgot to go home for lunch. One day, a new kid, tall and lean, came to the vacant lot, spinning a football. He spotted Maniac and stopped cold. He came closer, bent over, stared. Then he broke open a billboard grin and called out, "Hey, everybody, remember I said about the little white dude snatched the pass off me in gym class? Here he is. This is the dude." And this, of course, was hands down. The first thing Hans did when they chose up sides was to pick Maniac for his team. "You crazy, Hans," a high schooler laughed. "He's just a runt. His peach fuzz ain't even come in yet." Everybody laughed. But Hans took him anyway and played quarterback and threw passes to Maniac all day long. They huddled and scratched their plays in the dirt, down to the tin can and break for the goal. Stop and go at the rock, curl around the junk tire. If Hans's pass was anywhere near Maniac, if Maniac could get at least two fingertips on it, the ball was good as caught. The high schoolers and junior high schoolers went crazy trying to stop him. Nobody kept official records that day, but legend has it that by the time Amanda Beale showed up and called, "Jeffrey, dinner," Maniac had scored 49 TDs. And when they played stickball and they saw him pulling the ball out to the street and into backyards, they started putting two and two together, and somebody came up to him and squinted in his face and said, "You that maniac kid?" And somebody else said, "You that maniac?" And pretty soon everybody was saying it, including Hester and Lester. And finally, in the kitchen one day, as he licked white icing from her thumb, Mrs. Beale said it. "You that maniac?" He told her what he told everyone. "I'm Jeffrey. You know me." Because he was afraid of losing his name, and with it, the only thing he had left from his mother and father. Mrs. Beale smiled. "Yeah, I know you all right. You'll be nothing but Jeffrey in here, but..." She nodded to the door. "Out there, I don't know." She was right, of course. Inside his house, a kid gets one name. But on the other side of the door, it's whatever the rest of the world wants to call him. 15. Maniac's fame spread all over the East End. The new white kid, who lived with the Beals at 728 Sycamore, who ran the streets before the fathers went out, who could pole axe a stick ball like a 12th grader and catch a football like hands down, who was allergic to pizza, who jumped up in Bethany Church and shouted, "Hallelujah, amen." Little kids, especially preschoolers, came from all over bringing him their knots. They had heard about him from Hester and Lester. They had heard he can untie a sneaker knot quicker than a kid could spend a quarter. The bigger kids came around, too, for other reasons. From Moore Street and Arch Street and Chestnut and Green, heading for the vacant lot to check out the new kid, to test him, to see if everything they'd heard was true, to see how good he really was and how bad. They found out he could do more with the football than just catch it. He could run like a squirrel. He juked and jived and spun and danced and darted, and he left them squeezing handfuls of air. Pretty soon, the vacant lot was littered with blown sneakers and broken hearts. He didn't do much talking, but he didn't have to. Hands Down did it for him. Every time he scored a TD, or cracked a home run, Hands was bent over in his face talking trash. "Do it, man. Smoke them suckers. Poke them. Joke them. You bad dude, you the baddest. Five me, Jude." And they high-fived and low-fived and back-fived, and Hands Down would laugh and laugh. Maniac loved trash talk. The words were different, but in some strange way, they reminded him of church. It had spirit. It had what they called soul. Pretty soon, he was talking trash with the rest of them. And pretty soon, he brought it home. Mrs. Beale was pressing her famous meatloaf into a baking pan one day when Maniac started talking his trash to her. Her eyes shot open. She straightened up. "What'd you say?" He said some more. At first, she couldn't believe her ears. When she did believe them, she didn't like it. She didn't like this boy bringing the vacant lot into her kitchen, and she didn't like how it fit his mouth. So she put a stop to it right then and there and slapped that trash-talking mouth. Her lip started to quiver before his, but before she could say, "I'm sorry," he was hugging and squeezing her and burying his face in her chest and sobbing, "I love you. I love you." And he loved the quiet times after Hester and Lester went to bed. That's when he read Amanda's books. When he had gone through half of them, he figured it was time to tackle the Encyclopedia A. Problem was, Amanda was always reading it. And she vowed she wasn't giving it up, not even to Maniac, till she read everything from Aardvark to Aztec. To make matters worse, the supermarket offer had expired, so there were no other volumes. The more Amanda would not let go of the A, the more Maniac wanted it. It reached the point where she had to hide it whenever she wasn't reading it. Unbeknownst to her, Maniac always found it. He would get up even earlier in the morning, read it by flashlight for a while, sneak it back, and go trotting with Bow Wow. And sometimes, Maniac just sat at the front window, being on the inside. Maniac loved almost everything about his new life, but everything did not love him back. 16. Maniac McGee was blind. Sort of. Oh, he could see objects all right. He could see a flying football or a John McNabb fastball better than anybody. He could see Mars Bar's foot sticking out, trying to trip him up as he circled the bases for a home run. He could see Mars Bar charging from behind to tackle him even when he didn't have the football. He could see Mars Bar's bike veering for a nearby puddle to splash water on him. He could see these things, but he couldn't see what they meant. He couldn't see that Mars Bar disliked him, maybe even hated him. When you think about it, it's amazing all the stuff he didn't see. Such as, big kids don't like little kids showing them up, and big kids like it even less if another big kid, such as Hands Down, is laughing at them while the little kid is faking them out of their Fruit of the Looms. And some kids don't like a kid who's different, such as a kid who's allergic to pizza, or a kid who does dishes without being told, or a kid who never watches Saturday morning cartoons, or a kid who's another color. Maniac kept trying, but he still couldn't see it, this color business. He didn't figure he was white any more than the EastEnders were black. He looked himself over pretty hard and came up with at least 7 different shades and colors right on his own skin, not one of them being what he would call white, except for his eyeballs, which weren't any whiter than the eyeballs of the kids in the East End, which was all a big relief to Maniac, finding out he wasn't really white, because the way he figured, white was about the most boring color of all. But there it was, piling up around him. Dislike. Not from everybody, but enough. And Maniac couldn't see it. And then all of a sudden, he could. 17. It was a hot day in August. It was so hot, if you stood still too long in the vacant lot, the sun bouncing off a chunk of broken glass or metal could fry a patch on your hide. So hot, if you were packing candy, you had soup in your pocket by 2 o'clock. So hot, the dogs were tripping on their own tongues. And so hot, the fire hydrant at Green and Chestnut was gushing like Niagara Falls, courtesy of somebody wrenching off the cap. By the time Maniac and the rest of the vacant lot regulars got there, Chestnut and Green was a cross between a block party and a swimming pool, radios blaring, people blaring. Somebody selling lemonade, somebody selling Kool-Aid ice cubes on toothpicks, bodies, skin, colors, water, gleaming, buttery, warm, cool, wet, screaming happy. The younger you were, the fewer clothes you had on. Grown-ups sat on the sidewalk and dangled their bare feet in the running gutters. Teenagers stripped down to bathing suits and cutoffs. Little kids, underwear. Littlest kids, nothing. Maniac danced and pranced and screamed with the rest. He learned how to jump in front of the gusher and let it propel him halfway across the street. He joined in a snake dance. He got goofy. He drenched himself in all the wet and warm and happy. When he first heard the voice, he didn't think much of it. Just one voice in hundreds. But then the other voices were falling away in bunches until only this one was left. It was a strange voice, deep and thick and sort of clotted, as though it had to fight its way through a can of worms before coming out. The voice was behind him, saying the same word over and over, calling a name. And even then, Maniac turned only because he was curious, wondering what everybody was staring at. But when he saw the brown finger pointed at him, not a speck of icing on it, and the brown arm that aimed it, and the brown face behind it, he knew the name coming out of the can of worms' mouth was his. Whitey. And it surprised him that he knew. He just stood there, blinking through the water-drop sun blur, the hydrant gusher smacking his thin, bare ankles. The radios, the people, were silent.
"You move on now, Whitey," the man said. "You pick up your gear and move on out. Time to go home now."
The man was close enough to be catching some water around his shoes, which Maniac noticed were actually slippers. His pants were baggy, and his shirt wasn't really a shirt, but a pajama top covered with high-tailed roosters. White hair curled around his ears. Maniac gave his answer. "I am home." The man took a step closer, dropped his arm.
"You go on home now, son. Back to your own kind. I seen you at the block party. Now you get going."
Maniac stepped out of the gusher. The water roared onto the opposite curb. "This is where I live. I live right down here." He pointed towards Sycamore. The man didn't seem to notice.
"Never enough, is it, Whitey? Just want more and more. Won't even leave us our little water in the street. Come on down, see Bojangles. Come on to the zoo, the monkey house."
He must be hard of hearing, Maniac thought. So he called it out really loud and slow and pointed again. "I live at 728 Sycamore. I do." The old man stepped closer.
"You got your own kind. It's how you wanted it. Let's keep it that way. Now move on. Your kind's waiting."
He flung his finger westward.
"Up there."
Suddenly, Hester and Lester were by Maniac's side, barking at the man. You leave him alone, old rag picker. You shut up." And the man was croaking, ranting, not to Maniac now, but to the people.
"What happens when we go over there? Black is black, white is white. The sheep lie not with the lion. The sheep knows his own kind."
A woman was rushing in then, pulling him away up the street.
"Our own kind. Our own kind."
The water thundered across the silent street. Maniac, who was one of the world's great sleepers, didn't sleep well that night, or the next. He started getting up earlier than usual, not to sneak some time with the A-book, just to run. Bow Wow wasn't even ready for his morning pee yet, but he went along. Usually Maniac just jogged around the East End. Now he did the whole town, plus over the river to Bridgeport. By the third day, Bow Wow refused to go along. One morning, as Maniac was heading home, Hester and Lester came running up Sycamore.
"Maniac, come on. We're going to run, too. Let's go that way."
They tried to turn him around, but he told them to just hold on a minute. He wanted to stop home for a quick drink, then he'd go running with them. They kept yelling and tugging and pushing and grabbing his legs. And then Amanda was pedaling frantically up to him, slapping on a quick smile and gasping,
"Hey, I'm going to the store. Want to come along?"
Maniac checked the sun. It was hardly up to the second stories. "Stores aren't even open yet," he said. Amanda just gawked. She was a rotten liar, Maniac knew. He shook loose from the little ones and trotted on. He didn't know what, but something was wrong. The little ones jabbered and screeched and grabbed. He ran faster, faster. Mrs. Beale was out front with a yellow bucket, soap suds spilling over the brim, a stiff, bristled brush in her hand. She was scrubbing the house, the brick wall, scrubbing furiously at the chalk, grunting with the effort, her cheeks wet. He had been way too early, way too fast. Only the F had been scrubbed away. The rest was quite easy to read. The tall yellow letters, the same color as the scrub bucket. Ishbelly, go home. 18. Amanda tried to reason with him.
You can't listen to that old coot. He's goofy. He's always saying stuff like that. You can't go because of something one nutty old coot says.
Maniac pointed out that it wasn't the nutty old coot who chalked up the front of the house. Amanda laughed.
That? That's no big deal. It wasn't even paint. If they really meant it, they would have done it in paint. And anyway, don't you know they did my mother a favor? It gave her a chance to get out the old bucket and do some serious scrubbing. Ever since the kids stopped crayoning the house, she hasn't known what to do with herself. Now she's happy again.
Maniac didn't answer. Amanda didn't understand that most of the hurt he felt was not for himself, but for her and the rest of the family. She stomped her foot.
You gotta stay.
I don't gotta do anything.
You go, you'll starve.
Was I starving before I came here?
You'll freeze to death in the winter. Your fingers will get stiff. They'll break off like icicles.
I'll go somewhere.
Somewhere? Like the deer pen?
I'll be okay.
Or maybe Prairie Dog Town, huh? How about that?
She jabbed him.
You could live in a gopher hole. You'd be starving, so that would be perfect, because then you'd be so skinny you could fit right down there all snugly in their little tunnels.
He shrugged. Sounds cozy. This was driving Amanda bonkers. He was acting so different, all glum and wiseacre answers, as if he didn't care, not about anything.
Yeah, she sniffed. Well, what are you going to do for a pillow, huh? I know you put my pillow on the floor.
I'll use a hibernating gopher.
Funny. And bathroom, huh? Where will you go to the bathroom?
The bushes, McDonald's, lots of places. She hated it. An answer for everything. And the scariest part was, he was probably right. If anybody could survive on the loose, it would be this kid who showed up from Hollidaysburg, who slept on floors, who outran dogs. He was making her so mad. She pointed at him. She sneered.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, buddy boy. You better shut the door on your way out and lock it, because if I get my room back, I'm not giving it up again. So don't ever come crawling back around here.
She kicked him in the sneaker.
You hear?
Don't worry, he said flatly.
And don't think you're taking any of my books with you this time either. And you can forget about ever getting a chance to open my encyclopedia, eh? Which I was almost ready to let you do before you went and started acting all poopy.
He said, I'll join the library. She jumped up.
Ha! You can't!
No?
No, you need a library card.
I'll get one.
Ha, ha, you can't get a library card without an address.
She regretted it as soon as she said it. His head swung, his eyes met hers. His eyes said, why did you say that? Her eyes couldn't answer. He got up and went out and trotted up the street. Amanda cried. She tore a magazine in half. She punched the sofa. She kicked the easy chair. She kicked Bow Wow. Bow Wow went yelping into the kitchen.
See, she yelled at the front door. See what you made me do? Jeffrey McGee. Jeffrey Maniac Crazy Man Bozo McGee.
He wasn't back by lunch. He wasn't back by dinner.
I'm going looking, Amanda told her worried parents. No one tried to stop her. She rode her bike all over East End, West End. She even went over to Bridgeport, practically got herself killed on the bridge. She never pedaled so much in her life. She didn't come home till after dark. When her parents headed upstairs to bed, she asked if she could stay up to watch TV. They looked at each other and said, okay. She was nodding off in the middle of some late, late movie when the door opened and he walked in. What are you doing up so late? He said.
I'm incubating an egg, she snarled.
He shrugged and went upstairs. She closed her eyes and smiled. Next morning, a little kid from three blocks away came knocking at the front door. His yo-yo string had a knot fat as a mushroom. As Amanda watched Maniac tackle the knot, an idea slithered into her brain. When the little kid left with his string good as new, she said, Jeffrey, if I knew some way that would make it okay for you to stay, would you?
What do you mean okay? He said.
I mean, that even if there's one or two people who aren't too wild about you now, and that's all there really are, that even they would like you, and everybody else who already likes you, they'll like you even more. Purely out of curiosity, Maniac replied, How's all that supposed to happen? Amanda told him about Cobble's knot. 19. If the wonders of the world hadn't stopped at 7, Cobble's knot would have been number 8. Nobody knew how it got there. As the story goes, the original Mr. Cobble wasn't doing too well with the original Cobble's Corner grocery at the corner of Hector and Birch. In his first 2 weeks, all he sold was some Quaker oats and penny candy. Then one morning, as he unlocked the front door for business, he saw the knot. It was dangling from the flagpole that hung over the big picture window, the one that said Frosted Foods in icy blue and white letters. He got out a pair of scissors and was about to snip it off when he noticed what an unusual, incredible knot it was. And then he got an idea. He could offer a prize to anyone who untangled the knot, publicize it, call the newspaper, winner's picture on the front page, Cobble's Corner in the background. Business would boom. Well, he went ahead and did it, and if business didn't exactly boom, it must have at least peeped a little, because eons later, when Maniac McGee came to town, Cobble's Corner was still there. Only now it sold pizza instead of groceries, and the prize was different. It had started out being 60 seconds alone with the candy counter. Now it was one large pizza per week for a whole year, which in time made the knot practically priceless. Which is why after leaving it outside for a year, Mr. Cobble took it down and kept it in a secret place inside the store and brought it out only to meet a challenger. If you look at old pictures in the Two Mills times, you see that the knot was about the size and shape of a lopsided volleyball. It was made of string, but it had more contortions, ins and outs, twists and turns, and dips and doodles than the brain of Albert Einstein himself. It had defeated all comers for years, including J.J. Thorndike, who grew up to be a magician, and Fingers Holloway, who grew up to be a pickpocket. Hardly a week went by without somebody taking a shot at the knot and losing, and each loser added to the glory that awaited someone who could untie it. So you see, said Amanda, if you go up there and untie Cobble's knot, which I know you can, you'll get your picture in the paper and you'll be the biggest hero ever around here, and nobody'll mess with you then. Maniac listened and thought about it and finally gave a little grin. Maybe you're just after the pizza, since you know I can't eat it. Amanda screeched, Jeffrey!
The pizza's not the point. She started to hit him. He laughed and grabbed her wrists. And he said, okay, he'd give it a try. 20. They brought out the knot and hung it from the flagpole. They brought out the official square wooden table for the challenger to stand on. And from the moment Maniac climbed up, you could tell the knot was in big trouble. To the ordinary person, Cobble's knot was about as friendly as a nest of yellow jackets. Besides the tangle itself, there was the weathering of that first year when the knot hung outside and became hard as a rock. You could barely make out the individual strands. It was grimy, moldy, crusted over. Here and there a loop stuck out, maybe big enough to stick your pinky finger through. Pitiful testimony to the challengers who had tried and failed. And there stood Maniac turning the knot, checking it out. Some say there was a faint grin on his face, kind of playful, as though the knot wasn't his enemy at all, but an old pal just playing a little trick on him. Others say his mouth was more grim than grin, that his eyes lit up like flashbulbs because he knew he was finally facing a knot that would stand up and fight, a worthy opponent. He lifted it in his hands to feel the weight of it. He touched it here and touched it there, gently, daintily. He scraped a patch of crust off with his fingernail. He laid his fingertips on it as though feeling for a pulse. Only a few people were watching at first, and half of them were hex angels, a roving tricycle gang of 4- and 5-year-olds. Most of them had had sneaker lace or yo-yo knots untied by Maniac, and they expected this would only take a couple of seconds longer. When the seconds became minutes, they started to get antsy, and before 10 minutes had passed, they were zooming off in search of somebody to terrorize. The rest of the spectators watched Maniac poke and tug and pick at the knot. Never a big pull or yank, just his fingertips touching and grazing and peck-pecking away like some little bird. What's he doing? Somebody said. What's taking so long? He gonna do it or not? After an hour, except for a few more finger-sized loops, all Maniac had to show for his trouble were the flakes of knot crust that covered the table. He ain't even found the end of the string yet, somebody grumbled, and almost everybody but Amanda took off. Maniac never noticed. He just went on working. By lunchtime, they were all back, and more kept coming. Not only kids, but grown-ups, too, black and white, because Cobble's Corner was on Hector, and word was racing through the neighborhoods on both the east and the west side of the street. What people saw, they didn't believe. The knot had grown, swelled, exploded. It was a frizzy globe. The newspaper the next day described it as a gigantic hairball. Now, except for a packed-in clump at the center, it was practically all loops. You could look through it and see Maniac calmly working on the other side. He found the end, somebody gasped, and the corner burst into applause. Meanwhile, inside, Cobbles was selling pizza left and right, not to mention Zepps, a 2 mils type of hoagie, steak sandwiches, strombolis, and gallons of soda. Mr. Cobble himself came out to offer Maniac some pizza, which Maniac, of course, politely turned down. He did accept an orange soda, though, and then a little kid, whose sneaker laces Maniac had untied many a time, handed up to him a 3-pack of Tasty Cake butterscotch crimpets. After polishing off the crimpets, Maniac did the last thing anybody expected. He lay down and took a nap right there on the table, the knot hanging above him like a small hairy planet, the mob buzzing all around him. Maniac knew what the rest of them didn't. The hardest part was yet to come. He had to find the right roots to untangle the mess, or it would just close up again like a rock and probably stay that way forever. He would need the touch of a surgeon, the alertness of an owl, the cunning of three foxes, and the foresight of a grandmaster in chess. To accomplish that, he needed to clear his head, to flush away all distraction, especially the memory of the butterscotch crimpets, which had already hooked him. In exactly 15 minutes, he woke up and started back in. Like some fairy tale tailor, he threaded the end through the maze, dipping and doodling through openings the way he squiggled a football through a defense. As the long August afternoon boiled along, the exploded knot hairball would cave in here, cave in there. It got lumpy, out of shape, saggy. The Times photographer made starbursts with his camera. The people munched on Cobble's pizza and spilled across Hector from sidewalk to sidewalk and said, ooh, and ah. And then around dinner time, a huge roar went up, a volcano of cheers. Cobble's knot was dead, undone, gone. It was nothing but string. 21. Bugles, cap guns, sirens, firecrackers, war whoops. Cobble's corner was a madhouse. Traffic had to beep and inch through the mob. Kids cried for autographs. Scraps of paper fluttered down in a shower of homemade confetti. A beaming Mr. Cobble handed up a certificate to Maniac for the year's worth of large pizzas. Maniac accepted it and said his thanks. The undone knot lay in a coiled heap at Maniac's feet. Mr. Cobble grabbed it. Already people were guessing how long it was. It turned out to be 4.5 blocks long. Someone tied it to a stop sign and started walking, and that's how far he got before it gave out. The yelling went on and on the way yelling does, if only to hear itself. But one person wasn't yelling. Amanda Beale. She was holding one of the homemade confetti scraps, gaping at it. Then she was scrambling across the sidewalk, the street, shoving people's legs aside, grabbing more scraps, crying out, oh no, oh no. And then she was running. Maniac saw. He leaped from the table. He picked up a scrap. There was printing on it about Africa. He picked up another. This one mentioned ants. Another, Aristotle, the Encyclopedia A. He followed the scrap paper trail up Hector and down Sycamore all the way to the Beale's front steps. The only thing left of the book was the blue and red cover. It looked something like an empty loose leaf binder. Amanda was hunched over, rocking, squeezing it to her chest. It was my fault, she sobbed. I got careless. I left it in the living room. Anybody could look through the window and... She clenched her eyes so tightly it was a wonder the tears got out. More than anything, Maniac wanted to hug Amanda and tell her it was okay. He wanted to go inside, be with his family, in his house, his room, behind his window. But that wasn't the right thing. The right thing was to make sure the Beales didn't get hurt anymore. He couldn't keep letting them pay such a price for him. He turned and headed back up Sycamore. Maybe the man with the can of worms voice was right. Back to your own kind. Back to your own kind. He never got further west than the far curb of Hector Street, because McNabb and the Cobras were there to meet him, grinning, leering, hissing.
Yo, baby, we hear you got a little pizza prize there. Come on back. We missed you. We've been waiting for you.
So he turned and started walking north on Hector, right down the middle of the street, right down the invisible chalk line that divided East End from West End. Cars beeped at him, drivers hollered, but he never flinched. The Cobras kept right along with him on their side of the street. So did a bunch of East Enders on their side. One of them was Mars Bar, both sides were calling for him to come over. And then they were calling at each other, then yelling, then cursing. But nobody stepped off a curb. Everybody kept moving north, an ugly, snarling black and white escort for the kid in the middle. And that's how it went. Between the curbs, smack dab down the center, Maniac McGee walked, not ran, right out of town. Part 2. 22. If you were the baby buffalo at the Elmwood Park Zoo, it may have gone something like this. You wake up, you have breakfast, compliments of mother's milk. You mosey on over to the lean-to. Surprise! A strange new animal in there. Bigger than you, but a lot smaller than Mom. Hair, but only on top of his head. Sitting in the straw, munching on a carrot like Mom does. Every morning, same thing, you get to expect it. Some mornings you forget Mom's milk and you head right over to the lean-to. The creature offers you a carrot, but all you know how to deal with is milk. You nuzzle the new, funny-smelling, hairy-headed animal. It nuzzles you back. Mom doesn't seem to mind. After the nuzzling, the stranger climbs over the fence and goes away, not to return until that night. Only one morning, the stranger falls from the fence and lies on the ground on the other side. It doesn't move. You try to poke your nose through the chain links, but you can't reach. You can only watch. Only watch. The old man was bumping through the zoo in the park pickup when he spotted the body clumped outside the buffalo pen. He wheeled over, got out. A kid. At first, he could only stare at the body, then at the baby bison, whose large brown eyes seemed to be watching them both. The mother came lumbering over, nodding as if to confirm, a kid. The kid looked terrible. His clothes were scraps, rags. Wherever his body showed through, it was bony and dirty and scratched. The two bison staring seemed to say, "We'll do something." The old man gathered his own bones and muscles as best he could and managed to hoist the kid and get him into the pickup. He laid him on the seat, bent his legs so he could close the door. He knew he should take the kid straight to the hospital or a doctor, someplace official, someplace right. But the pickup just sort of steered itself back to the band shell, and there he was, lugging the kid into the baseball equipment room. The season was over by now, but the army green burlap bags still stood ready for the next ump to call play ball. He yanked out a couple of chest protectors and laid the kid down, careful with his head. At least he was breathing. Though it wasn't cold, it seemed as if the kid ought to be covered, so the old man took his winter work jacket off the hook and laid that over him. Then he waited and watched. With trembling, dusty fingers, he touched the kid's limp, scrawny hand. He had never really touched a kid's hand before. "Hey." The kid's voice was barely a squeak, but it threw him back. He dropped the hand. "Where am I?" The old man cleared his throat. "The band shell." "The band shell?" "In the back, equipment room." The kid's eyes squinted, blinked. "And you? What about me? Who are you?" "Grayson." "Grayson, do I know you?" He got up. "Guess you do now." He went to his hot plate, heated up some water, and made some chicken noodle cup of soup. He gave it to the kid, who was sitting up now. "You want a spoon?" He looked as though he could hardly lift the cup. He held it with both hands and gulped it down. "Huh?" he said. "Never mind. You still hungry?" The kid flopped back down. "A little." "Wait here," said Grayson, and left. 10 minutes later, he was back with a Zep, a large. It took the kid less time to polish it off than it had taken Grayson to get it. He told the kid not to eat so fast, he'd get sick. The kid nodded. Grayson said,
"Where'd you get them scratches?"
"Oh, some picker bush."
"What were you doing there?"
"Hiding."
"Hiding from who?"
"Some kids."
"Where?"
The kid pointed. "Somewhere out there, some other town." He crossed his legs Indian style on the chest protector. "Can I ask you a favor?"
"Shoot."
"Can we go somewhere and get some butterscotch crimpets?"
Grayson squawked. "Crimpets? You still hungry?"
"For them, I am." Grayson threw the greasy Zep wrapper into the waste basket.
"I don't know. Maybe you ought to do something for me first."
"Like what?"
"Like tell me your name."
"It's Jeffrey McGee."
"And where you live?"
"Well, I did live on Sycamore Street, 728.
"Did?"
"I guess I don't anymore." The old man stared.
"You said Sycamore?"
"Yep."
"Ain't that the East End?"
"Yep." With his fingernail, he scraped a path of dirt off the kid's forearm. He stared at it.
"What are you doing?" the kid asked. "Seeing if you was white under there."
Neither spoke for a while. At last the kid said, "Anything else you want to ask me?"
The old man shrugged. "Guess not."
"Oh, come on, don't stop asking."
"I'm asked out."
"How about the zoo, huh? Don't you want to know what I was doing at the zoo at the buffalo pen?" The old man sighed.
"Okay. What?"
"I was living there."
"With the buffaloes?"
"Yep, with the buffaloes."
"You like buffaloes?"
"It was dark when I got there. I thought it was the deer pen.
They switched the deer and the buffaloes around last month."
"Okay with me. I got along better with the buffaloes anyway."
"Well, I tell you one thing," the old man sniffed. "You sure do smell like one."
The kid laughed. They both laughed. When they finally calmed down, the kid said, "Any chance of those crimpets now?" Grayson reached for the pickup keys.
"Let's go."
23. Grayson got the crimpets all right. He bought a whole box of 3 packs. With 10 packs to a box, that was 30 butterscotch crimpets. Maniac thought he must have climbed out of that buffalo pen right into heaven. Then Grayson took Maniac home. Home for the old man was the Two Mills YMCA. He lived in a room on the 3rd floor, but he didn't take Maniac up there. He took him downstairs to the locker room. He got him a towel and a cake of soap, told him to take off his rags, and pointed the way to the showers. Maniac stayed in the shower for an hour. He hadn't done this since his last bath with the little ones. He smiled at the thought of them shrieking and splashing. The shower needle stung his scratches, but it was a good welcome back to town stinging. When Maniac finally forced himself from the shower, he found the old man waiting with clothes, Grayson's clothes.
"I called the U.S. Army in to haul them buffalo rags away," he said. "They come in with gas masks on, and they use tongs to pick them up and put them in a steel box, and they took that box away to bury it at the bottom of the first mine shaft they come to."
Maniac couldn't stop laughing. Neither could Grayson, especially when he got a load of the kid drowning in his clothes. An hour later, after a minor shopping spree, Maniac had clothes of his own. For the rest of the afternoon, they cruised around town talking and eating crimpets.
"So," said the old man, "now what are you gonna do?"
Maniac thought it over. "How about a job? I could work for the park, like you." Grayson didn't answer that. He said,
"Where you think you're gonna stay?"
Maniac's answer was prompt. "The baseball room, it's perfect." A tiny idea was beginning to worm its way into Grayson's head. He could barely feel it as it brushed by all the claptrap in his brain. He ignored it. He said,
"What about school?"
Maniac was silent. Some butterscotch icing had stayed behind on the wrapper. He scooped it up and mopped it from his finger, wishing it were Mrs. Beale's and not his own. Grayson, who was not comfortable asking questions, was even less comfortable waiting for answers.
"I said, what about school?"
Maniac turned to him. "What about it?"
"You gotta go. You're a kid, ain't you?"
"I'm not going."
"But you gotta, don't you? They'll make you."
"Not if they don't find me." The old man just looked at him for a while with a mixture of puzzlement and recognition, as though the fish he had landed might be the same one he had thrown away long before.
"Why?" he said.
Maniac felt why more than he knew why. It had to do with homes and families and schools, and how a school seems sort of like a big home, but only a day home, because then it empties out, and you can't stay there at night because it's not really a home. And you could never use it as your address because an address is where you stay at night, where you walk right in the front door without knocking, where everybody talks to each other and uses the same toaster. So all the other kids would be heading for their homes, their night homes, each of them, hundreds flocking from school like birds from a tree, scattering across town, each breaking off to his or her own place, each knowing exactly where to land. School, home. No, he was not going to have one without the other. "If you try to make me," he said, "I'll just start running." Grayson said nothing. What the kid said actually made him feel good, though. He had no idea why. And the brushing little worm of a notion was beginning to tickle him now. He kept on driving. 24. They got back to the bandshell just as they finished the last of the crimpets. Grayson looked at his watch.
"Guess it's time to quit the job I never did today. Time for dinner, too."
Grayson was joking, but Maniac was serious when he piped, "Great, where to?" Dumbfounded, the old man drove back out of the park to the nearest diner where he sat with a cup of coffee while the boy wolfed down meatloaf and gravy, mashed potatoes, zucchini, salad, and coconut custard pie. Grayson had a way of jumping into a subject without warning. It was during Maniac's dessert that he abruptly said,
"Them black people, they eat mashed potatoes too?"
Maniac thought he was kidding. Then he realized he wasn't. "Sure. Mrs. Beale used to have potatoes a lot, mashed in every other way."
"Mrs. who?"
"Mrs. Beale. Do you know the Beales of 728 Sycamore Street?" The old man shook his head. "Well, they were my family. I had a mother and father and a little brother and a sister my age and a dog. My own room, too." Grayson stared out the diner window as if digesting this information.
"How about meatloaf?"
"Huh?"
"They eat that, too?"
"Sure. Meatloaf, too, and peas and corn. You name it."
"Cake?"
Maniac beamed. "Oh, man, you kidding? Mrs. Beale makes the best cakes in the world." Grayson's eyes narrowed.
"Toothbrushes. They use them?"
Maniac fought not to smile. "Absolutely. We all had our toothbrushes hanging in the bathroom."
I know that, said Grayson, impatient. "But is theirs the same as ours?"
"No difference that I could see."
"You didn't drink out the same glass."
"Absolutely we did." This information seemed to shock the old man. Maniac laid down his fork. "Grayson, they're just regular people, like us."
"I was never in a house of theirs."
"Well, I'm telling you, it's the same. There's bathtubs and refrigerators and rugs and TVs and beds." Grayson was wagging his head.
Ain't that something? Ain't that something?
It was after dark when they got back to the baseball equipment room. The worm in Grayson's head had long since ceased to be a tiny tickle. It was now a maddening itch. As with all such itch worms, it would exit only by one route, the mouth. He said,
I was thinking, maybe you want to come over to my place. This here floor's pretty hard.
He tapped his foot to show how hard. The grizzled gray old parkhand could never know how much Maniac was tempted or how deeply the offer touched him. Neither could Maniac explain that the bad luck he always seemed to have with parents had led him to the conclusion that he'd better stick to himself. Oh, it's not so bad here, he said. Look. He lay down on the chest protectors and closed his eyes. Ah, just like a mattress. I can feel myself dozing off already. And then, not wanting to hurt the old man's feelings, he added quickly, Hey, I told you everything about me. How about you? He pulled Grayson's coat over himself. A bedtime story. Grayson snorted.
Story? I don't know no stories.
Sure you do, Maniac prodded. About yourself. You know, about you. Everybody has a story.
Not me.
Grayson was edging for the door.
I ain't got no story. I ain't nobody. I work at the park.
You line baseball fields?
Yep, I do that.
You live at the Y, you drive the park pickup, you like butterscotch crimpets?
Grayson shook his head. Not as much as you. I was just eating them to be friendly so you wouldn't have to eat them all by yourself.
And there's another thing about you, Maniac joked. You're a liar. They both laughed. Grayson opened the door. Wait, called Maniac. What did you want to grow up to be when you were a kid? Grayson paused in the doorway. He looked out into the night.
A baseball player, he said.
He turned out the light and closed the door. 25. In the morning, Grayson bought Maniac an Egg McMuffin and a large orange juice. He brought the same thing for himself, so they ate breakfast together in the baseball equipment room. You sent me to bed without a story last night, Maniac kidded. Grayson brushed a yellow speck of egg from his white stubble.
I don't got no stories, I told you.
You wanted to be a baseball player?
That ain't no story.
Well, did you become one? Grayson drank half his orange juice.
Just the minors, he muttered.
Maniac yelped. The minors?
Couldn't ever make it to the majors.
There was a frayed weariness in the old man's words, as though they had long since worn out. Grayson, the minors? Man, you must have been good. What position did you play? Grayson said,
Pitcher.
This word, unlike the others, was not worn at all, but fresh and robust. It startled Maniac. It declared, I am not what you see. I am not a line-laying, pickup-driving, live-at-the-Y, bean-brained park hand. I am not rickety, whiskered worm chow. I am a pitcher. Maniac had sensed there was something more to the old man. Now he knew what it was. Grayson, what's your first name?
The old man fidgeted. Earl, but call me Grayson like everybody.
He looked at the clock on the wall.
Gotta go.
Grayson, wait.
I'm late for work. You ought to be in school.
He was gone. Grayson returned at noon bearing Zeps and sodas and was not allowed to leave until he told Maniac one story about the minor leagues. So he told the kid about his first day in the minors with Bluefield, West Virginia, in the Appalachian League, Class D.
Can't get no lower than that, he told the kid. That's where you broke in. don't have D-ball no more.
He told about thumbing a ride to Bluefield and, when he got there, going up to a gas station attendant and asking which way to the ballpark. And the gas station man told him, "Sure, but first I gotta ask you something. You're a new ball player, right? Just coming on board?" And Grayson said, "Yep, that's right." And the man said, "I thought so. Well, then, you're just gonna wanna make your first stop right over there." He pointed across the street. "That there restaurant, the Blue Star, you just go right on in there and sit yourself down and tell the waitress you want the biggest steak on the menu. And anything else you want, too, 'cause it's all on the house. The Blue Star treats every new rookie to his first meal in town free." He gave a wink. "They want your business." Great, thought Grayson, and he did just that. Only when he got up and left, the restaurant owner came running after him down the street, all mad at Grayson for skipping out. And when Grayson told him he was a rookie, just picking up his free first meal, the owner got even madder. Seems the gas station man was a real card and liked to welcome dumb rookies with his little practical joke. And that's how it came to be that when the Bluefield Bullets took the field that day, they did so without the services of their new pitcher, who was back in the kitchen of the Blue Star restaurant doing dishes to work off a 16-ounce steak, half a broiled chicken, and 2 pieces of rhubarb pie. After a story like that, Maniac couldn't just stay behind, so he tagged along when Grayson went back to work. He helped the old man raise a new fence around the children's petting farm yard. When the park superintendent came around and asked about the kid, Grayson said it was his nephew come to visit for a while. The superintendent, who managed the budget, said, "We can't pay him, you know." And Grayson said, "Fine, no problem." And that was that. From then on, Maniac was on the job with Grayson every afternoon. They raised fences, mended fences, hauled stone, patched asphalt, painted, trimmed trees. They ate breakfast, lunch, and dinner together, sometimes in the equipment room, sometimes at a restaurant. They spent weekends together. All the while, Grayson told baseball stories, insisting all along, "I ain't got no stories." He told about the Appalachian League, and the Carolina League, and the Pecos Valley League, and the Buckeye, and the Mexican Leagues, about the Paducah Twin Oaks, and the Natchez Pelicans, and the Jessup Georgia Browns, and the Laredo Lariats, all minor league teams, minor league baseball, sleazy hotels, sleazy buses, sleazy stadiums, sleazy fans, sleazy water buckets, curveballs and bust fumes and dreams. Dreams of the majors. Clean sheets and an umpire at every base. Funny stories. Happy stories. Sad stories. Just plain baseball stories. The happiest story being the one about Willie Mays before he went up to the New York Giants in immortality. Well, it was old Grayson himself who had last crack at Mays in the 9th inning of a game with Indianapolis. And what did Grayson do? All he did was set the Say Hey Kid down swinging on 3 straight curveballs. The saddest story was the one about the scout who came down from the Toledo Mud Hens. The Mud Hens had a roster slot, and the scout had a notion to fill it with a pitcher with the wicked curveball, name of Earl Grayson. This was Grayson's big chance, for the Mud Hens were class AAA ball, 1 short step from the majors. The night before the game, Grayson spent half of it on his knees by his bed praying, and even 5 minutes before the game, in the dugout, he bent down pretending to tie his shoe and closed one eye and prayed, "Please let me win this ball game." Which was something, since he had never gone to a church in his life.
"God must have fainted," he said to Maniac.
And indeed, maybe God did. Or maybe he only listened to major leaguers, because Grayson took the mound, and proceeded to pitch the flat-out awfulest game of his life. His curveball wasn't curving, his sinker wasn't sinking, his knuckler wasn't knuckling. The batters were teeing off as if it were the invasion of Normandy Beach. Before the third inning was over, the score was 12-0, and Grayson was in the showers. He was 27 years old then, and that was the closest he would ever get to the big show. He hung on for 13 more years, a baseball junkie, winding up in some hot tamale league in Guanajuato, Mexico, until his curveball could no longer bend around so much as a chili pepper, and his fastball was slower than a senorita's answer. He was 40, out of baseball, and for all intents and purposes, out of life. All those years in the game, and all he was fit to do was clean a restroom or sweep a floor or lay a chalk line or far, far down the road tell stories to a wide-eyed homeless kid.